Today on 9 Works Radio, we're celebrating 50 years of Impact Bumper 911s.
Brought to you by 9works.co.uk, the fastest growing online Porsche community, supported by the 9works marketplace. 9works Radio is your dedicated Porsche and car podcast, hosted by Lee Sibley, Andy Brooks, and Max Newman. 9works Radio is carefully produced with special input from experts around the industry and powered by our valued members of the 9works Driven Not Hidden collective.
Good day, Mr. Sibley.
Mr. Brooks, how are you?
Very well, very well. Caramax is otherwise disposed this evening.
Yeah.
So it's just the and me.
Yeah. His whereabouts are unknown. We think he's out there wooing the ladies somewhere with his dulcet tones and smooth Caramax vibes. or possibly deputising on the shipping forecast. I don't know. I can imagine that would suit him pretty well.
Very good. Poor Max.
Max, we miss you. We're sure you'll be back next week. It is just Andy and I, and it's a special episode that we're delivering you lovely listeners today because we are celebrating 50 years of Impact Bumpers, completely serendipitously as well. Yeah, it's also new car day.
I know. Can you believe it? I mean, this has been in the planning for quite a few weeks, hasn't it? Months, if not this episode.
Yeah, but Christmas. Yeah. We said we'd do it this week.
Yeah, yeah. And this morning, I picked up my 1978 SC. Would you believe?
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And you very kindly gave me a lift over there to pick it up. The road in Ferndown, which seems crazy, doesn't it? Pick it up on the way to work, which is nuts.
Yeah. It was like textbook perfect car collection day. You know, the sun even popped out for us.
Yeah, I waited for the sun.
Drive to collect it, you know?
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful car. Looks amazing. You were so right as well when you said it looks, I mean, the pictures were phenomenal. I want to clarify straight away, but you know,
they were done by Richard Pierce, actually.
Who
took my pictures in that dark warehouse a little while ago that were in another magazine.
Are available. There's some fantastic shots. And like you said, you know, the car looks even better in the metal.
It does.
Than it does in the awesome pictures. So phenomenal. When that car was kind of pulled out of the garage and reversed back and like that first ray of sun, like pinged off that metallic paintwork.
Oof. That paint is amazing, isn't it?
It looked beautiful.
It's a special wishes color dolomite gray.
Yeah.
And it's got such fleck in it. And it just comes alive with sun. It's just, whoa.
Yeah. I was saying to you, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Meteor Grey from like the modern palette or 997 palette, but with a bit more ping to it.
Yeah. It's pretty special, isn't it?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it is. It's really special. I mean, of course, I think the interior is the most special part of that car in terms of
what did
rarity,
you think to that when
you opened
the door?
Yeah, like, I loved it. It's yeah, look, I love it. I think in this day and age, having something with a bit of flair and a bit more flavor is absolutely bang on the money to be absolutely cool and seen. do you know what I mean? So that's bang on. It's kind of funny because perhaps, you know, one stage of its life that might have been undesirable.
Well, the owner did say that when he bought the car 18 years ago.
Yeah,
it had that interior, and he was like, "Oh, should I get it retrimmed? So, thankfully, he didn't. And he's kept it in amazing condition and looked after it. All of the seat bases have been reinforced; they were removed, taken off, and then reinforcing material put back on and restitched because apparently it was just slightly starting to. So not split, but, you know, losing its integrity.
Yeah,
it's done a good job looking after it.
You mentioned on the podcast last week, and in seeing the car now, I have to completely agree that is the right car for you, as it's.
Yeah.
And may I also say that you're also the right owner for the car. You know, it's very kind of, it's been very well looked after.
Yeah, and Phil has just done an amazing job over the last 18 years.
Yeah, yeah, who, like you, is clearly very mechanically empathetic.
Yes, yeah, engineer by trade.
So the car doesn't want for anything. It's absolutely mint. And to be honest, like, you know, following you out on your very first drive as the owner of that car, like following it down the road, I mean, like, what a stance.
Isn't it? It's just fantastic.
It looks great with the sevens and eights, you know, as we'll, yeah, kind of, we'll cover. But
and,
just
and
like,
lots of meat
the
on the tyres. Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah. What's your first impressions there? Going from 993 ownership, going backwards in terms of years to an SC?
Well, it's interesting because I've almost been waking, well, pretty much for the last week or so, I've been waking up at 5:30 each morning. And it's like been running through my mind, you know, what have I bought? How different is it going to be to the 993? Is it going to live up to my expectations? Am I going to feel like I'm going to need to update stuff? Is the suspension going to need to be better than it is already? You know, is it going to be right? And that's been going round and round in my mind. At lunchtime today, I took it out for a drive out to Blandford to go and see the boys down at Barnsport. And I took the little back roads that go down between Spetsbury and off to Blandford. There's a lovely little section of road goes through there over the river, and there's some nice little curves. And it just felt so natural straight away. It was just, you know, hit a few curves. It feels light and punchy, kind of makes the 993 feel almost a bit, oh, I don't know, a little, I don't know what it, no, I need to think about that more, about how different they are. But it is different, but amazing. Well, I love it.
Well, you're going to be negative and then realize you haven't sold the 993 yet. Press the abort button.
I didn't have full thoughts on it. I need to wake up at 5:30 in the morning again and put the full capacity to it.
Well, look, what was it then that made you wake up one morning and think, I need to get out of a 993? And yes, you might keep that car, but metaphorically speaking, I need to jump out of a 993 and I want some impact bumper ownership in my life.
So I've been wanting one for quite a while. I think when I was looking around for an air-cooled car, you know, back if four or five years ago, I looked at a S, no, it wasn't an SC, it was a 3.2 that Camford Classics had for sale. It was dark grey, black interior, had loads of miles on it from what I can remember, like 200,000 odd, but it had lots of work done on it. That was 60 odd K. It was outside of my my budget at the time, but I really liked the look of it. I thought it looked amazing, sounded amazing. So I've always had a hankering for them all the way back to then. And I remember going when we were at Luft, there was loads of impact bumpers there that I really loved. But the 993 came, you know, I was open to anything, 993, 964, impact bumper. And the 993 came up and it was the right car for me. When did it sort of start again? You know, because I'd had the 993 for a bit, was probably when we were at Carnatta. Remember that meet we had last?
Yeah,
Red Line days. And Hugh turned up in his gold SC, flat back. And it just, like, I was like, really do love the look of those. And just, they're classy. And then last summer, I went out with Anthony Sandback, who's got a 3.2 Carrera. We had a quick blast around North Dorset. And I was following him. And he was having a whale of a time in his 3.2 because it's got that extra bit of ground clearance to my 993. Yeah. He was just ripping it down the lanes, you know, a little bit narrower. He was having such a good fun and I was following it and thinking, oh, that's lovely. So, yeah, all those different things had sort of built up over the years. So I've been constantly sort of thinking about it and, yeah, we've talked about it on the podcast over the last, I guess, almost a year, haven't we, of my hankering for one. So,
It's great that you're finally going to be scratching the itch. We did a podcast just for our Works and Hero drivers of the collective.
Yes.
Last week. And you kind of divulged in that podcast that you'd been to look at a Sportomatic impact bumper Targa, which needed a little bit of work and whatnot.
Yeah.
And, you know, by contrast, the car you've got now seems to be kind of just perfect in every way and is a car that you can really enjoy this summer. Whereas that car, and it's you know, this aforementioned Sportomatic Targa is a cool project for someone, but you're not going to be doing a lot of driving in that this
correct
summer.
Yeah. So it was usable, but it would have been usable with trepidation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it had, the engine hadn't been rebuilt on it. There was suspension that was probably a little bit baggy. So you could have used it, but yeah, you would have driven it with a bit of trepidation, where I know that I go across Europe in that thing tomorrow. The stuff that's been done to it and the condition of it, it's just ready to rock and roll. And, you know, the difference in the price is not crazy, to be honest.
Mm.
Yeah, there's definitely it's more what I've bought, but it's not an engine rebuild, kidney bowls, a respray, an interior retrim. It's definitely not the difference. So, yeah, big difference in condition for not a crazy amount of extra money, really.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic, Mr. B. Yeah, I'm well chuffed for you, and we all are from within the collective. So I'm sure we speak on behalf of the entire collective community when we say, yeah, many happy miles ahead for you, good sir.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Looking forward to them.
Well, look, as we said, serendipitously, Andy has bought an Impact Bumper car on the day we're doing our Impact Bumper special for Night Watch Radio listeners. So look, there we go. Look, I'm sure you'll know, but it's worth just kind of covering from a historical point of view for those that don't know as to why, like, the Impact Bumper cars came along. So when the 911 came to be in 1963/1964, by the time the first production run happened, they're bereft of those bumpers that were added to the front and rear of the car at 1974. And if you Google, you know, early 911 and then Impact Bumper 911, you'll see what we mean. They were stipulated essentially by the US market, which was a critical market for Porsche, was and still is. So there was a two-pronged attack, really, from the US market. It was safety, but also emissions. So there were changes going from the pre-impact bumper cars, of which the 911 lineup at the time was 911T as the entry level, then E, and then S, with 2.4-litre flat sixes, naturally aspirated, of course. That was for the F-series cars of 1973. Then we came to the G-series cars, which was model year 1974, and the lineup changed from TES to 911, 911S, and then the top-level car was Carrera, a name which, of course, is very well known these days within Porsche circles. The 2.4-litre engine went up to 2.7 litres. There was a change as well, like gone were carbs and everything else that were known, particularly or latterly with 911Ts on the pre-impact bumper. It was switched out for Bosch K-Jet fuel injection, a mechanical fuel injection on the Carrera, the top-level car. So, yes, look, we're in this impact bumper era. It's commonly referred to as the G-series, but actually the G-series was just that 1974 model year. That was what Porsche internally called that. And then so obviously the 75 model year was the H series, I, J, K, et cetera, et cetera. But it is commonly and colloquially known as the G series cars. Mm. So G series / impact bumper lasted from 1974 to 1989 with the introduction of the 964. And we'll talk about it a little bit more coming up on the podcast. But essentially, if you put a 1974 car next to a 1989 impact bumper car, they're going to look pretty much the same at face value. There are, of course, a lot of changes. As ever with Porsche, it's this kind of constant approach to evolution. So there are a lot of changes, and we will document them coming up. But Andy Brooks, I've got some stats to run past you for this impact bumper era. So there are a total of, from 1974 to 1989, 174,083 impact bumper cars produced rolling off the line at Zuffenhausen. For context,
that seems less than I was expecting.
Less, really?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, don't forget these were all properly like hand assembled, weren't they, at the time? So 174,000. Compare that to 175,996s in just 8 years, which wow. of course then adopted a completely different approach to production. It was that just-in-time principle. So 174,000 over 15 years. The most voluminous, not even sure that's a word. So
that's a good word. Go for it.
Apologies to all journalists out there if that doesn't actually exist or is not used in the correct context. But the most common impact bumper car was the Carrera 3.2 with 70,000 examples. The rarest, any guesses?
It's the 3, isn't it?
I guess. It's a 3-litre
car. Carrera 3.
The
Carrera 3.
It's a 3-litre car, but it's the SCRS, which has
yes,
a 3-litre
of course,
engine. So, yeah, the lineage of those impact bumper years was 2.7 litres to 74 to 77.
Yep. 77.
Then there was the Carrera 3 for two yep. model years. Then we went 3-litre Remain with the SC, allegedly called Super Carrera, from 78 to 83.
No, you say that allegedly. Is it like folklore, or is it
nobody really knows.
Okay.
And yeah, like it is allegedly the case in combining the former 911S, which used to be the top rung 911,
yeah,
with the Carrera that replaced it, allegedly, if we do our maths, gives birth to SC, Super Carrera.
Okay.
But in Porsche literature, certainly from what I've seen, it's never referred to officially as Super Carrera.
Carrera, okay.
And then we had our final iteration of that engine was the 3.2, which was introduced for 83-84 and took us right up to 964 production. But yeah, the rarest is the SCRS, just 21 examples made. That was, though, a race car. It wasn't a road car. The lightest, you mentioned the RS 3-litre, did you not?
I didn't, but no, go on.
The Carrera 3, yeah. Well, the lightest was the RS 3-litre from 1974, weighed just 900 kilos.
Wow.
Feather light. The fastest impact bumper was the 930 3.3 at 173 mile an hour top speed, not including, of course, the 959, which kind of overlapped the latter period
yes,
there.
Absolutely.
So the 933.3 is the fastest impact bumper 911. It's also the quickest as well, with a 0-60 dash of 4.6 seconds. Still fairly respectable by today's.
Yeah, absolutely.
By barometer set by today's cars. But yeah, just some quick stats kind of gives a bit of an overview of the impact bumper era. Going forward on this podcast, Andy, you're going to be giving us owner reports week by week on what it's like yeah. living with one of these cars. We will talk to the guys at Paragon Porsche very shortly. We're going to get them on. They're going to give us absolutely all of their extensive knowledge when it comes to impact bumper cars. We'll then speak to Andy Gregory at Heritage Parts Center, who's going to offer some insight into the most popular, most common upgrades. And then we're going to head to Rightune for a deep dive into the 915 versus G50 gearbox debate that is perpetual.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to demystifying it.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's hope we can do that.
Yeah.
There's been lots of chat over many years, isn't there? Which is the better and who likes this, who likes that? But yeah, it'd be quite interesting to demystify the actual truth of what the differences are between the two.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So we're pulling on many friends from around the industry to deliver this podcast, which we hope will deliver a holistic look at those impact bumper years. There's so much to cover. We could spend an entire series yeah. talking about these cars.
It could be a 3-hour podcast. It could be our record.
there's so much to talk about. So I'm sure we'll cover different aspects of it going forward in future podcasts, without a doubt. It's a yeah. real lovely period in Porsche history, it has to be said. Lots going on. I mean, even away from the G series cars, this whole period was when Porsche then looked at, yes, turbocharging, but then also had that introduction of the transaxle cars, which were meant to replace the 911. Yeah. Porsche Engineering also then started building engines or building aeroplanes and trying to take the flat six into the sky. So it's a really interesting and awesome
time.
Yeah. So we'll cover all of that, some today and a lot going forward, I'm sure. So
fantastic. Shall we speak to the guys at Paragon? See what they know.
Let's do that.
Cool.
Mark and Jason from Paragon Porsche, thanks for joining us on 9Works Radio.
Good day.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good evening. Hi, good to hear from you again and actually see you, because we have got vision here, haven't we?
it's wonderful to have you back on the airwaves for Nine Works Radio, talking, of course, about Impact Bumpers, our 50-year special episode dedicated to Impact Bumpers. Serendipitously as well, with Mr. Brooks buying his SC. So this is all just tying up marvellously here.
It's crazy.
Congratulations,
isn't it?
Andy.
Yeah, we saw that. It looks absolutely fabulous. It's great. Yeah. Lovely colour combination.
I think it's
awesome.
It's mental. Absolutely mental. Yeah, the colour is just perfect. Exterior and interior. It's just, it's what a package.
Yeah, and I like Carl's name as well for it. That was superb. Thermidor. That's just bang on.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
Top job. Yeah, I picked it up this morning. Lee gave me a lift. So I bought it about a week and a half ago, but it's been, the weather's been absolutely awful. So, very kindly, the guy that was selling it kept it in his garage for a week and a half for me until a good day came. And today was the good day. So, worked out perfectly.
All okay? Running okay?
Beautiful. Amazing. Yeah. Quite outstanding. I took it down to Barnesport today to go and see Scott, because he's only about 7 miles from work here. He had a quick drive of it and gave it the thumbs up. So
no need to strip it down into a million pieces and
a
load of shiny bits and bolt it all back together.
I don't know what I'm going to do with my evenings.
You're going to have to talk to Sarah. That's it now.
Oh, poor thing. She's going to have to hear me rabbiting on about Porsches and all sorts of rubbish.
And did I hear that you're planning to have the two Gustavo as well?
Yes. I'm very lucky, in a very lucky position where I can have two for a little while.
Yeah,
let's see what happens over the coming weeks. My initial drive today was like, oh, this is gorgeous. I just love it. I love the sound of it. I love the feel of it. I love the ride. I think the only thing that I'm yet to master is the gearbox, but I'm sure that will come, because obviously it's a 915 gearbox, which is notorious. But
sort of get used to it not being biased to any of the gates, basically.
Yes. It just makes you think about it, really.
The sticks where you last left it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I think we've got quite a good conversation coming up later about 915. And G50s. Looking forward to learning.
It's a lovely car, Andy. It was great to see your face as you were climbing into that for the first time. It's a lovely colour. What I will say is, to my mind, when I think of Impact Bumpers, incorporating SC and 3.2, of course, quintessential Impact Bumper, said on the podcast before, is a Guards Red Sport with a whale tail
behind Mark.
Yeah, just like the car over your shoulder, Mark, that's sitting resplendent in the showroom there. These cars, and this is why it's great to have you guys on. You've obviously been selling them for years, essentially. There are some fantastic, we'll call them archive shots, that we've seen on your social media page.
Yeah. Brilliant.
From way back when basically the 964 was new or nearly new, and there were some as good as new 3.2 Carreras lining outside the front of Paragon there. So you've sold them for, years and years and years. You obviously like the cars enough to sell them.
Yeah, I mean, it's when we started in the early 90s, the 964 was the new, the current 911 was the 964. Mm. So 3.2 Carreras were 3 years old, four years old, So it's...
That's mental.
So we were selling early on, we were selling a lot of SCs, a few 3.2 Carreras and turbos, and the first time we had, I remember the first time we bought Carrera 4 964, it was a massive day for us. It's like this equivalent of sort of, well, obviously buying a brand new 992 today. So, we weren't buying many of those and then obviously the business was very, very, very young. So, it was exciting when we first got the 964 in.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you might have noticed, by the way, we're missing the person that you need Mark needs really to bounce off at this point, i.e. Jamie. Because Jamie, unfortunately, the last time we spoke on one of your podcasts, Andy was down with something unmentionable.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And this time Jamie has sort of taken that bug. So he's unavailable. So yeah, I mean, I came along a little bit later. I was been a bit slow. And so it's the early years stuff. Unfortunately, no idea. Wasn't here.
Well, you've still been here long enough, Jay, anyway. So you definitely know what you're talking about. But again, from your guys' your point of view, you can offer such like wonderful historical context. And I think what I'd like to know from the off is the 964 was quite a step change, allegedly 80% new above the axles over the G-bodied car. So was the 3.2 Carrera at that point still as revered? Was it perhaps more revered because purists would point to the fact it didn't have ABS and power steering and all the rest of it? Or did that become quite a hard sell in comparison to this technological Tour de Force 964 when that was new?
So mechanically, when the 964 was new or nearly new, people were worried about this dual mass flywheel. That was the equivalent of the intermediate shaft or intermediate bearing or ball scoring or whatever. You know, it was all talk was all about dual mass flywheels and the judder you'd get from, because the early ones weren't as reliable as they were later on. And also some of the early 964s suffered with oil leaks. So they were the two things that people talked about, worried about with the new cars. But
so the distributor thing as well.
The distributor belt that used to snap as well. Yeah. But the fashion wise, obviously, in 1989, there was a big recession. It was sort of 1989, 1990. And when you watch the news then, they would, when they talked about the recession, they would have a man with a mobile phone and red braces and a guard's red 911 with a whale tail. So by the time we started the business, people didn't want any 911 with a whale tail because that was just associated with sort of the 80s and all the, you know, and the recession and the yuppies and all of that. So we were really quite busy. If we bought cars in with whale tails, we took a lot of whale tails off and trying to sell a guard's red car with the spoilers on was really, really hard.
Wow. Yeah, that's unimaginable amazing. Now. Unimaginable.
How many skips did you fill with whale tails?
Well, quite a lot of whale tails. And then also there was a company out then that was called Stuttgart Connection. And he's actually, it was a guy called Mark King, who's the brother of Richard King that owns Carmen Connection.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And Mark used to sell us replica cup wheels and teardrop mirrors and fiberglass bumpers. And we converted loads and loads of G-series cars into 964 lookalikes.
Bloody hell.
Because they were really cheap donor vehicles.
Yeah.
And they were a bit unloved, you know. So we did a lot of those. You know, normally then with a color change and bits and bobs, and people, you know, when the cars had dropped to a, you know, they were as cheap as buying the cheapest 986 Boxster or something today, you know. So even, you know, we had a couple of Carrera Club Sports, 3.2 Club Sports on the forecourt, but just, I think that they were obviously always worth a bit more, but they were under £20,000. I think it's £17,000, something like that.
My word.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Club Sport, that's such an interesting car. I feel like people have never really understood that car. I love them. I really rate them. Don't know what you probably dislike them, Mark, because
I tend to sit at polar opposites. I don't dislike them. But as you know, I'm a massive fan of 964 RS.
Let's get that one out.
And I don't think that a Club Sport's comparable to a 964 RS, you know, but they're similar monies. And I really like Club Sports, but, you know, they are, when you look at the weight saving and, you know, they didn't do anything pretty well. They did. They put some hollow valves in the engine and it revved 500 revs more, but there was no more horsepower on things. And it had the same ratio gearbox. It wasn't, you know, it didn't have any aluminium panels on it. To me, it's not quite, you know, it was an effort to build a slightly stripped out 3.2 Carrera for people to go and race in things like the Porsche. You know, when I first raced in the Porsche Club Series, there were two genuine club sports on the grid.
Wow.
And that's what they were for.
Yeah, yeah, that's what they're designed for, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's a succinctly put argument there, Mark, and I'm not even going to respond to it because, it's just, you've eloquently dusted me off there. So it's kind of, fair enough. I love them. And I think, with the values of them relative to 964 RSs, it's a numbers game, isn't it? 340 produced.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it comes down to. It's a quirky part of Porsche history. It's certainly not an RS, but there was nothing else like it of the time. There was an SCRS that was, of course, a race car. It wasn't a production road car at all. But that's it from that entire impact bumper era.
I actually drove one for about 6 months, and I really, really enjoyed it. You know, without the rear seats, you get a bit more noise from the engine as well. And I do like them. I think they're really good cars.
Yeah. I love the idea, but I think now, with where they've gotten, and as you say, Lee, it's a numbers thing. If there were 340 of them, crumbs, that is mega rare, isn't it? So you can sort of understand how these things go. And there's been plenty of Porsche cars, special edition things that have come out recently or in relatively recent history, which, are very valuable. And a lot of that is just, is mostly due to the sort of super low number thing. But I think, I'd certainly love to drive one of those cars. I don't think I've ever driven one. So,
I was parked next to one at Bournemouth today because we popped into Bournemouth Porsche after I picked the car up. And there was
on Andy's tour of Great Britain in the SC.
Hey, look what I got.
It was pretty much that, yeah. But mine was parked next to a club sport. But it was really interesting, Lee, wasn't it? The wheel offset. I know it's going a bit off camber here, but the wheel offset was quite small compared to mine. Well, I've got eights and nines on mine.
Yeah, so a club sport actually came with 6-inch front wheels on it as standard.
We thought they were
9-inch rears. In '88 they were sixes and sevens.
Yeah,
and then by '89 they kept the front wheel and put a 9 on the rear. And you always think, well, with a 9 on the rear, why did they not put an 8 on the front? Which is what most people ended up doing because the balance was better. But as standard, it was still a 6 on the front.
That's why they look so tiny then today.
Yeah. They really sat in the art. It looked really odd next to your SC, Andy, it has to be said.
Yeah, with my big balloon tyres.
Whereas a 964 RS has got perfect wheels. And your magnesium.
Is
that a drum I can hear in the background? The 964 drum.
We've been talking about this in 10 years, you know that, don't you, Lee?
Yeah. And they look best in ruby stone, don't they, Mark?
Absolutely.
back to impact bumpers.
Oh, yes.
I don't really want to gloss over that from when it was new to now, but at the same time, I do want to get an understanding of where those cars sit in the market today. To my mind, values-wise, if you tie them with the 964 and 993 brush, the G-Series cars, I think, are easily forgotten in the marketplace, and I'm not sure why that is, but I'd like to know if you agree with that.
Well, I think that it's 993, you're likely to use more, aren't you, with ABS?
And
the gear change, the whole thing. It's an easier car to use, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, we still see around here, several that are being used all of the time and, throughout the year and that sort of stuff. And some of that has got to come down to the fact that, it's an easier car to live with on a day-by-day basis, just naturally because it's that bit younger and has got, as Mark said, ABS brakes and probably some AC that just about sort of dries it out and that sort of stuff. They are old now. I mean, the one that we've got is a later car, an 87 car.
Yeah.
But that's still 36 years old.
Mm.
And, they were so prevalent. They were out there and they were so tough and so durable is maybe something we'll be getting onto in a bit. I don't know. But, they were so good and so strong and they were used in so all weathers and they were, modified and changed and whatever. And there's so few now that that are really kind of really solid, integral, you know, proper good starts, I think.
Good survivors, yeah.
Survivors, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That are the sorts of car that I'm drawn to. And I know that's not that, you know, it's just me, you know, I want a really solid original thing, you know, and work from that and make it the best as of, you know, the best 87 or 84 or whatever it is, you know, of its era. And I'd drive it in context and that sort of stuff. I know that's just me, but there's very few of those cars. There's really, really very few, you know, they're not, although they're valuable. This is a, you know, constant thing. I'm sorry if I bore anyone, but it's like, they're not, the numbers aren't big enough yet that you can do, you know, the complete full on full house restoration job on one and it make financial sense.
Yeah, be viable.
I mean, yeah, you can do the, you know, I mean, if it's this car that you love, obviously you do it, for God's sake. It's like Jethro. I was listening to your thing last night, actually, which is why, thank God, this is not in you know, on camera effectively for everyone to see, because the bags around my eyes are unbelievable. but it's, I was listening to your podcast last night, and, you know, what he's done with that, you know, his dream car isn't, well, it's 906. You know, it's just fantastic, but my God, you know, he's not going to get the money out of it again, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. You do see, and Andy, that is exactly the operative word, survivors. You do see so few survivors that are like unmolested, unfettled. It's, yeah. I suppose that's
because this bunch of hooligans here were putting 964 bumpers on them. And that's
actually, Andy, about 15 years ago, we bought one back, one of our 964, you know, replicas, yeah, if you like, and we restored it back to an SC. It was 180 horsepower SC and beautiful, like blue metallic, and it still had a full history and all of the, you know, the meat of the car was still correct, if you like, albeit it had the wrong bumpers and the wrong wheels and bits and bobs. And we actually, it needed doing again. So we restored it back to its, we had to find some bumpers. We obviously hadn't kept any of the stuff. We restored it back.
Well, you're looking at me, Mark, now, and I'm sort of like trying to think.
More than 15 years
ago. I think, and sadly, I think
some time ago we did that.
Yeah.
That is an interesting point, though, because in this day and age, we're all used to hearing about back dates. But actually, yeah, forward dates were quite prevalent then in trying to keep up with that look of that new 964. So, did you see a lot of them?
That was the big thing that you were saying at the time, wasn't it? It was updating those cars to look like a 964.
And also, I mean, you know, we're talking about G-series cars here, but we also took a lot of mirrors and wheels off standard Carrera 4s. We would fit a lower spring, a TechArt spring kit, set of cup wheels and the teardrop mirrors to make a, you know, an early 89 964 look like a later car. So that was being done as well. I mean, and the wheels were worthless. You literally, we used to have a guy that used to turn up, a sort of VW guy that used to sell the front, four of the front wheels to his mates with the buses, you know.
So
the D90s, So I don't know what happened to the rears. He probably just scrapped the rears and
probably got junked. Yeah, too wide.
I even remember going to Volkswagen shows and the field would be awash with design 90s on Golf Mark IIs, Mark IV Polo. So it's Corrados, nice to know they all came from Paragon at one stage. Supplying the VW scene, without a doubt. But by virtue of the fact that there aren't many of them left in like an unmolested state, I suppose prior to that showed how open those cars were to modification as well.
Yeah, well, the parts on all of these sort of torsion bar cars are very, I haven't really thought about whether the later cars were, so I don't think they are, but with cars from, if I look at my 1965 2-litre car, you could basically put a 1989 torsion bar in that car. You know, so they didn't change the length. Where did they change? No, they didn't change them. You know, they're all, so it's all interchangeable. So it's quite easy to put sort of turbo brakes on an early car or turbo suspension steering, all that sort of thing. You could interchange all of the parts. So, you know, the actual chassis underneath the car is very, very similar, isn't it, all the way through. So, yeah, I think it was a car that works well for, you know, for people to modify and things like that.
So, I mean, is it also, therefore, does that mean that kind of the G-series cars effectively were kind of are probably the best ones for people that are actually, you know, like Andy, for some ability and, you know, for modification and playing around with or whatever, if that's what you want to do?
Yeah.
Would that be easier or better, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's less electronic gizmos on them, aren't there? They're pretty simple, aren't they? Obviously, without, you know, you haven't got power steering, so you don't have all the ancillaries that go with power steering. And, you know, if you don't have these luxuries on the car, they can't go wrong, can they?
Exactly that.
Absolutely.
Exactly that. With that in mind then, Mark, when do you feel the G-series cars were most popular? Is it now or is it previous? Like, could you like put a bracket of years to it?
I think they're popular to different people. So, you know, when we started the business, the cheapest, you know, if someone wanted to buy a car for £6,000, they could buy a 180 horsepower 911 SC. Sorry, Andy. So I guess now, you know, a £6,000 2.5 Boxster, isn't it? Or whatever, you know, so it's whatever the car at that stage, that car was sort of 17 years old or something. So that was the cheapest 911, I think. Having said that, even the 2.4Es and things were similar money. So, you know, they weren't classic cars then. They were just old 911s. So they got used for track days a lot because obviously, you know, nowadays people buy the right car for a track day. They buy a GT car, don't they? GT4, GT3, if they can afford it. Back then they used to buy, you know, an old torsion bar car and fit bigger anti-roll bars, and lower the car, which is easy to do, and fit wider torsion bars to make it sort of work and some sticky tires. And that was the track day car, you know, and the Porsche Club Championship was just full of SCs. You know, the whole grid, I think we like 25 SCs in the Classic Championship. And then in the Club Championship, for those who could afford it, were 964s, but then a lot of 3.2 Carreras. And the 3.2 Carrera always went run quite a bit lighter on the racetrack to sort of equal out the difference of brake horsepower. So, a lot of them were being modified, definitely.
Yeah, it's crazy because I remember distinctly it was 10 years ago, 2013, and I was looking at a 911 SC. Can't remember what color it was now. But Mark, I sent you an email with the link to the car saying, yeah, what do you think of this? And it was brilliant because you straight away said, well, the interior is different to spec, what it should be. I think it was either older or newer, but all these bits, you know, it's got the wrong steering wheel, XYZ. You were able to give this complete synopsis on the car in minutes as to how different it was. It was a big learning curve for me. As we were talking about, Jay, as you mentioned, it was far from stock. Yeah. So heavily changed from factory spec. But that car, I think, was, £11,000.
Yeah.
It was only 10 years ago. You know, if you, it was an SC or a 996 as your entry level Porsche. And they were sort of kicking around that sort of money, albeit with incorrect interiors and different steering wheels and everything else. But it's amazing where they went only 10 years ago to where they are now.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because now you're sort of saying who buys them or where the audience is now, because I think there's a real mixture, isn't there? Because there's definitely quite a lot of modified cars when you go to the shows. There's quite a lot of still modified cars, but there's also people that want a factory original car. You know, so it's difficult. I mean, the cars we tend to deal with, as you know, sort of, we try and find the best cars and recondition them as factory original cars. So we're only sort of seeing half of, well, probably less than half, isn't it? Probably 20% of that torsion bar sort of car market. Hence, we end up buying things like, you know, we've sold more speedsters and,
and quite a few of
late turbos and things. I think that's mainly because that audience works with Paragon more than, you know, the because we don't do sort of modified cars. So it's, it's not like we prefer those cars, you know, and the car we've got now is lovely. But we're just not offered cars that work for us, really, are we?
Sadly, it's a real shame because, you know, we love them. I mean, I you know, I've grown to love them. As I've said previously, I think, you know, I've worked my way backwards, you know, in my Porsche 911 love and appreciation. And, you know, I absolutely love it. This is one of three cars this year. So I'm pointing at my shoulders, which is pretty pointless, isn't it? On radio. but yeah, it's this, the R32. It's one of three cars this year that I had to drive. One was a GT2 RS, for fairly obvious reasons. The other was a 986 Boxster that you may have seen on that website recently. The third car of those three that I've driven this year that I really thought I had to drive was the 3.2. And the people that I had came down and drove it with me were not born when that car was actually built. And it's just, that seems quite extraordinary to me, but I guess it's going to happen more and more. But it's just, I mean, it's really nice. So they were 30-ish and absolutely loved it. I mean, and they had a 901, you know, a 901 Gen 1, I think. And they just, and she, yeah, that's right. And she had a Macan Turbo S, I think, so a Macan Turbo. And, you know, I took them out of it and they were absolutely bowled over by this car. And I just thought, that's fantastic. That's really, I get a tremendous buzz out of that. I mean, I would naturally assume that that car will go to, you know, reliving a time or period or when they perhaps couldn't reach that far, but now can, you know, economically, financially. But I mean, to see, you know, another generation of people that would actually dig in this car. I mean, it's so heartening. You know, it's really exciting.
That's a testament to how good they are though, isn't it? Because, you know, I drove mine today. I was 8 when mine was born. It's bloody 8. That's just nuts, isn't it? And I drove it today and it was just like, wow, this is amazing. It just feels like it's come out of a bit of rock. And it just drives like a
it's
better than any of the shit cars, you know, that I've had before. It's just better than anything I've had before. Not shit cars, good cars that I've had before.
8's the age you need to be if you want to sit in the back of it.
absolutely. Yeah,
it's migrated forwards as it's got older.
So I guess the other thing to say is that 80s and 90s is super fashionable at the moment. So you know, it's nice for us. Hopefully, we can buy and sell more of these 80s cars because they've got to sort of, you know, people are appreciating them and will pay for a really great car. Whereas you know, there has been a period where we just can't. Touch, you know, we love them. I've got two torsion bar cars myself and I love them, but we haven't really been able to touch them as a business to make money from them and you know, make sense of buying a great car in. But we also always have to spend quite a bit of money. You know, people get used to things not working on their cars. It might be electric seats or the heater fans or the servos on the mirrors or the heated rear screen, but everything costs quite a lot to fix. And we always send the cars out with everything working. So, you know, for us to buy and sell a 35-year-old car, it needs to be worth a certain amount of money for us to be able to get involved with it as a business. And now, hopefully, the values, you know, I don't want the values to go up, but it can make some more sense to us if there's an audience out there that will appreciate what we've done and what we're asking for the car.
And invest in the quality of stock as well.
And I also like the fact that they're fashionable again with the spoilers on, you know, and we're not having to take the, you know, we're not having to modify the cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, tell is cool.
it's kind of good that the, I mean, when I was, you know, first here, and I'm sort of, you know, broadly, I guess just over half of the time that Paragon's been open, I've been here. So there was quite a lot of Paragon before I got here. And it's interesting, you know, we touched upon the Guards Red thing. We touched upon the yuppie thing. There was still a massive anti Guards Red. And, you know, I didn't see it quite so much with the impact bumper stuff because we weren't having quite so many by that stage. But there's a massive anti Guards Red sort of sentiment and that sort of thing, which must have clung on to those cars more than anything else because they were the car.
Yeah.
And, so it's really refreshing. And this, we can, you know, we can follow this line of logic or argument or whatever it is, you know, to talk about 906, you know, that's the same situation occurring now, but I think it's happened. It's been gaining a bit of momentum now for a while, obviously with the 80s cars. So people have got over it. You know, it's not the bloody car's fault.
it's interesting because Andy's 993 being red. I mean, there were hardly any red 993s. They were silver, dark metallic blue, grey, but they weren't red.
No, there's not many of those about. Yeah,
no, and that's because there was a real, you know, for
backlash. Yeah,
at least a dozen years, people just wouldn't buy a red car.
Yeah. I've never correlated that. That's such a good point.
20 years. I reckon it was probably almost 20 years of damage. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, because as you say, you know, for G Series, a red car was almost ubiquitous, really. Mm. So yeah, Porsche red, made a move away from it.
Well, they basically.
Yeah.
You know, we sold a 3.2 Targa to a good customer, didn't we, a few years ago, a non-sport Targa.
Oh, yeah.
Which was granite green, was it called? It was dark metallic green.
I think so.
Or sort of mid metallic, grey green, with like a tan interior or something, which would have been in the 80s. Would have been like the salesman said, are you sure? You know, it would have been one of those.
Yeah.
No spoilers, a sort of a grey green metallic. You know, it would have, it's all the wrong things. It should be red, white, or black, and it should have spoilers, you know. So it would have been a real, a real.
It was interesting actually talking to the previous owner of my car. He bought it 18 years ago. And when he bought it, his initial impression was, Jesus, look at that interior. I'm going to have to get that retrimmed. But now, you know, he changed his mind. He was like, no, actually, I think I quite like it. And he never got round to retrimming it. I mean, now it's just like hen's teeth and
Is it actually salmon? Is it called salmon?
It's a red lobster vinyl. And then it's got the orange pinstripe.
Right. Because a friend of mine has a brown 1979 3.3 turbo, metallic brown.
Yeah.
This guy used to race with, and the interior was salmon leather. And after, everyone used to take the mickey out of John with this car. And about 15 years ago, he phoned me and said, oh, I've had the turbo retrimmed. And I said, oh, great, what colour? And he went, same colour.
Salmon.
But it looks so cool now.
But
the car as well, you know, it's great.
Yeah,
it's come full circle.
Good for him.
I'd like to split down into the different models of that impact bumper generation now, because it's a broad spectrum through the 15 years. So SC versus 3.2 Carrera, for the layman, what are the differences?
How about the 2.7s?
Well, I'm going to come on to that.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to come on to that because there's an interesting footnote with a Carrera 3 as well.
All right.
You've
got this
fade.
Panned out. Good.
I have. Yeah. There's a little bit of semblance in there somewhere, Andy. But yeah, if you wouldn't mind, just for the everyman and woman, what are the main differences? And from your point of view, like which era do you prefer?
So my knowledge is that 77 3-litre SC came out, 180 horsepower. For that 1 year, it had chrome windows and chrome window frames and chrome headlight rims. But obviously the impact bumpers, so the black bits on the bumpers and things. And the following year, all of the bright work was satin black. Car was unchanged for 79. So you have the, you have the sport or the non-sport, being obviously the sport had the Bilstein dampers, so slightly stiffer front and rear spoilers, but mechanically was the same car. And then by 1980, the 81 model year, they were 188 horsepower. And then in when the 80, I might be wrong here, the 204 horsepower came out for the 81, 82 model year cars.
82, yeah.
Yeah. And that's when they put side repeater lamps on the wings.
Yeah.
And introduced the cabriolet. Is that right,
Lee? That's it. Yeah, 83 was when the cabriolet introduced. And it's funny what you said about the side repeaters. When I see an SC, that's how I can tell if it's the 204 horsepower car. I look for the side repeaters because, as you rightly point out, Mark, and your knowledge is incredible. And it's worth pointing out, during the COVID lockdown, when I was doing my online quizzes on Instagram, there's a reason you were winning most weeks. It has to be.
I remember that. You know,
I didn't know about it.
I have to confess, my knowledge does stop. mid-noughties.
964s.
So I've got knowledge, but it's all stuck in this sort of,
that is really great.
Specialist subject.
Considering we've just put you firmly on the spot there, that's absolutely bang on. Like the SCs are lighter than the 3.2s.
Yeah. I was going to lead on to saying I actually have a soft spot for the 180 horsepower. It's a different engine. It zings. It's a bit like a 2.2S versus a 2.4S. You know, a 2.2S is a really revvy engine, and a 2.4 has more torque. And it's similar, you know, if you've got a 180, I actually really like the way the 180 engine revs and zings. Yeah, it's got a little bit less horsepower, but you just have to keep it on song, if you like, you know.
What's the mechanical differences then between the 180 and the 2.4?
I don't know. I think that is when you drive them, the 204's got, it's more the torque that you feel than the brake horsepower. I'm trying to think, I'm pretty sure that there's more compression.
Yeah,
on the 204. And I think it was because fuels were better or the injection system was improved. But the big difference when you drive a 3.2 Carrera is the way the fuel was injected. Obviously, the mechanical injection was getting old. It wasn't as fuel efficient. It definitely wasn't as good for the environment, because as you come off the throttle, Andy, with your car, you'll sort of get pops and bangs in the exhaust pipe because it doesn't shut the fuel off.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas the Motronic system was quite clever. It would know your altitude. It would retune the engine. You know, on a hot day, it had knock sensors, all that sort of thing. So it was more precise how it put the fuel into the engine. And if you're going down a long hill and you come off the throttle, it would cut the fuel completely.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the revs dropped below about, I think it was about 1100 revs, you'd get an idle system that would come in that would, so you'd have no fuel, and then you hear it drop to about 1,000 revs, and then you'd suddenly, it would pick up on an idle stabilizer thing that was, but it was all, it was quite clever for its time with the, with the electronics. And it made, obviously, they increased the capacity to 3.164, so 3.2 Carrera, but basically they suddenly gained about 25, 30 horsepower. So it was quite a lot, and quite a bit of torque as well. But it was basically pretty much, I mean, obviously it was mechanically different. I think they put the crankshaft out of the 3.3 turbo in the 3.2 Carrera. So it was a different stroke and slightly wider bore. But the big difference was the management, the fuel injection.
Cool. Bang on. What an unbelievable synopsis that is, Mark. Unbelievable. You are right. Just looking up with some research here in the back of Total 911, the difference between the 180 and the 188 horsepower cars, is a slight uptick in compression. For the 204 horsepower, it was quite a major uptick by the looks of it.
Right.
Torque's pretty similar for all SCs from 80 through to from 78 through to 83.
Oh, is it? Right.
Yeah. And what I've read in the past was when the SC came out, although it had, and an SC is talkier than a 3.2 from my driving experience, it just, yeah, it feels like more of a talky car. It had more torque than its predecessor, the Carrera 3, but was perceived to be down on power. The Carrera 3 had 197 horsepower, I think it was. And then the SC came out of 180. And a lot of Porsche owners were disgruntled. So they were taking their brand new 911 SC down the road to Roof. And Roof, pretty quickly, pretty sharp out of the blocks, developed a power kit that I think gave the SC 210 horsepower.
Wow.
So the story goes, there were a lot of these brand new SCs rocking these Roof power kits, which is why Porsche tried to kind of over the years tweak the cars to give it not more torque, because it was a good setup, but that basically the pub stat of more horsepower, more to match these Roof cars. But evidently Roof did okay out of it. Their legend was cemented by that.
How interesting
wasn't
is
it?
That?
Yes, they were basically.
I'm interested in what you said about torque and stuff, because I, you know, I've driven a few, but not a lot, and it's over a long period. So, you know, I'm not the expert, but I always thought of like an SC to me seems to, in my memory, is kind of a bit more zingy than a 3.2. But I mean, like I say, I mean, I'm relying on a memory which is really quite old now. Though I would assume if it's sort of more zingy in my mind, then I'm thinking it's more sort of revvy and
especially as it was a shorter stroke as well, because the 3.2 was the long stroke.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Then I guess.
Yeah.
But
I think it was only stroke that was the difference between the 3 liter and the 3.2.
4 millimeters. The pistons are 4 millimeters wider.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the problem with the Carrera, I like the 3 liter Carrera, other than they didn't put a brake servo on a 3 liter Carrera, and they're horrendous, you know, with the disc, the type of caliper they were using, discs all round with no servo. You know, you just had to really, when we used to sell them, the steering wheels were quite often broken. The three spoke steering wheel, and the top two spokes would be fractured. And it was because people would try and pull a steering wheel to try and give themselves more pedal pressure because they had such horrendous brakes. But a lot of people with Carrera 3s would fit an SC brake servo.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, as I was saying, it was an interesting footnote in Porsche history with the Carrera 3, because it was only around, I think, for two model years. And, I mean, it was the 930 engine without the turbocharger, was it not? And that's why it's got the five blade fan, rather than it was the only one that had five. There's not many of them around. I don't know the numbers, but you don't often see a Carrera 3.
I don't think this is right, because it sounds like the year, but I mean, were there like, no, it can't be right, can it? There can't be 76 UK cars. That doesn't make sense at all.
It could be.
It could be, you know.
Yeah,
it could be.
Right, okay. Well, I think I heard that.
Rare beast.
Yeah. Just trying to look up the numbers.
We had one in here. That was one that went to DE.
Yes.
It was the Sportsmatic one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, beautiful. It's Minerva blue with the sort of, I can't remember what it's a sort of check.
It's got a check interior. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's lovely.
And it's an odd gearbox. I mean, I did drive it quite a bit. I'm not sure I've kind of really mastered it, but I mean, that is such a cool car. I'd love one of those.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Andy, we did a bonus pod for some of our Driven Not Hidden collective, and Andy kind of was saying there that he'd gone to look at a Sportomatic G-body Targa, and in the end, it was up in an auction. It needed a hell of a lot of kind of work, but I think that's an interesting point to touch on, is, you know, just how expensive are these to run? They're quite simple to drive, I suppose. Like we were saying, they haven't got all of the additional refinements of 964 and 993, which, as you said, Mark, is more to go wrong, but
If you were to buy a really great car that was you know, not reconditioned, but ready, you know, as prepared as they were in the day, and everything worked, and you looked after it, and there was no rust on it, then they're really, really, it's one of the easiest 911s to own.
Yeah.
What people quite often say is, oh, this servicing was so expensive, and they're getting confused between servicing and a running restoration. You know, and so many people are actually, what they're doing is they're restoring the car slowly over a 10-year period, and then they're blaming it on expensive servicing. The servicing is, you know, if you look at your invoice, the servicing is the top two lines, and then it was the next 15 lines of fixing stuff that wasn't working when you bought the car. And, yeah, you know, it's a running restoration, and people have to be sort of honest. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with a running restoration if that's what someone can afford, and, you know, going with your eyes wide open type thing with those cars, you know, because there's a lot of them out there that, you know, we've got a couple of customers that sort of pop in from time to time, and we're helping them, and, you know, they're doing a bit themselves and we do a bit, and every year the car gets a little bit better, but it's just an ongoing restoration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're, going back 15 years, you know, when they were cheap, you know, when a 3.2 with a load of miles on it was really quite cheap. You know, they if they were running and they were still kind of maintained, they might be rotten in, you know, many places, but if they were running, they'd keep running, and they'd just keep going and going and going. It would not probably perform the way that Autocar said in the back of, you know, whatever, that's or whatever, but it's still, you know, and it would smoke quite a bit and all the rest of it, but they just keep going. You know, it's just a question of when the oil slick outside your house, or the plumes of smoke, or whatever was too much.
I just think we've just rebuilt an engine. Well, not me, Jay and I.
Yeah.
Kieran in our workshop's just done an engine rebuild on a 3.3 turbo, and it came in with an oil leak. It had 13 broken head starts.
Wow.
It drove in, you know, it drove in with 13 broken head starts.
13?
A car that refuses to die. That must be more than half of them broken, isn't it?
Yeah, well, 4x6, isn't it? So it's 24 head studs.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah.
11 good ones.
Mental. That's absolutely
so. At least one cylinder didn't have any bolts holding it on, or just one rather than two. Yeah. Most of them had two head bolts and one head bolt.
Yeah, I guess carriers, you know, you've got the cam carrier that fits on top of the head, haven't you? I guess so. Yeah. I guess that was taking a lot of strain.
Yeah.
That's just nuts. Crazy.
But still running, you know, still running and driving and things. Yeah.
They chug along, but it depends on what you want. I mean, now I think everybody would want better than that, I think, now.
<You're> tight.
I don't know. I haven't met everyone, but, you know, I'd like to drive it so that it felt like it did when it was a bit newer, you know, or whatever, fresher. But
Take some abuse.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, that memory's going back. It's fair to say, isn't it? You know, our service manager back, way back when.
Yeah, Mick, yeah, one, didn't you, Mick?
So Mick, you know, got a car that we had looked after for, about 15 years at that point. And this guy was a proper user. I mean, you know, he was doing 20,000 miles a year. And I think Mick picked it up with like 215,000 miles, and the engine had never been apart. And he ran it, and, you know, all weathers. And I think he finally took it apart at 235 or something, not because it was, I mean, it was still going, still starting, still stopping, still doing what it's supposed to do. But he just thought, no, I'll lavish some money on it. I'm going to rebuild the engine and this sort of stuff. So he started getting into that. But in a way, that was a kind of classic point in that he was going to do that bit. But then realistically, the whole of the rest of the thing had done a very, very good day's work and was really quite tired by then. But, you know, that car still lives. I'm pretty damn sure. I'm pretty sure it's out there So, you know, you can bring them back. It is possible.
Or keep the car.
Keep them simmering away. Yeah.
Away from the engine. Mm. Rust. We can't have this conversation without talking about rust.
Yeah.
Where should Andy be looking?
The kidney bowls. You probably know about kidney bowls, don't you, Andy?
It's been done, thankfully. Yeah
but because you have to take the door shuts.
The work.
Yeah, because you have to basically cut both door shuts out and the bottom of the rear wings, and then you sort of peel up the rear wing, the rear quarter panels, and then do the major surgery under there. It's an area that looks like a kidney, I guess, because it's called a kidney bowl.
Yeah.
And you weld these in. And it's because they don't have any wing liners. So when you look on later cars, they have these plastic underbody liners, if you like.
Yeah.
Whereas wheel arch liners, whereas with the 3.2 Carrera, if you have a bad winter or if you drive down a muddy road, it all flicks up, deep into the wheel arches.
Yeah.
And then it just sits there like damp, like a damp sponge. So unless, what you'd obviously say to people is that, when we have them in for service, we spend some time cleaning them all off and then spray some wax back in those areas. But that, again, it didn't get done for years and years on certain cars, and they do rust there. So it starts really, if you're looking at a car, have a good look around the striker plate on each door and see if there's any bubbles there. Mm-hmm. Then really you're likely to need to spend, depending on who you speak to, but it's between £5,000 and £10,000 to fix those, because you end up having to put new door shuts in and weld panels in the wings as well as the kidney bowl. So then there's quite a lot of paint work involved in, mm-hmm. You end up painting that back half of the car.
But don't worry, Andy, none of this is happening to you.
Mine's been done, thankfully.
Yeah,
mine was done about 8 years ago, I think, and I think the bill was about $8,000. Brilliant.
Yeah, just bill just was, remember.
The bill was $8,000, I think, and that included paint down both sides, the whole, they did the wings from front to back.
Just getting nervous. Look, they've done it here. Look at the paper.
Justifying it.
So other than those, then you've got obviously bubbles under the headlights. You sort of see, the front wings can rust either around the headlights or at the back edges of the wings. You can get just sort of bubbles there. Then you can live with that. It's not going to stop you using the car because the headlights won't fall out unless it's really bad, and it's not structural, but it's just ugly to see that. Around the front and rear screens, like any 911, especially if they've had the wrong person replace the windscreen, they sort of scratch through the paint, with their wires and things when they cut the screens out, although they're on rubbers. So you get a little bit of rust around there. Other than that, it'll just be, the floors don't rust and things, do they?
Not so much. Mixed one, possibly.
You're then really just looking to make sure the car hasn't had the wrong people working on it or accident damage. It's obviously an old car, so you've got to trace back through 30 odd years of
gearboxes.
Gearbox, obviously, synchro meshes on the lower gears, whines from the gearboxes, engine oil leaks, obviously.
This is where, and it's a great point that you're highlighting here, the repair costs to fix all of this would be astronomical. So it really does pay to buy the very best car you can, because in the long run, you're going to be saving a hell of a lot of money. To put right what you've said, you'd be buying a cheap car all over again.
Yeah. And also, if you buy the best, when you come to sell it, it's a lot easier to sell the best of anything, isn't it? It's always easy to sell the best example of something.
Yeah,
definitely. Where do you guys stand on the turbo look cars?
I like Super Sports. I think the Super Sport suits a coupe more than any other. I'm not a great fan of a Super Sport convertible.
Mm-hmm.
The convertible, at that stage, I mean, nowadays you jump in a convertible and it handles and drives the same as a coupe, pretty much, doesn't it? They feel torsionally stiff.
Mm.
You've got to remember 30 years ago, they weren't. So ideally, if you've got a convertible or Targa, you don't really want wide wheels and low profile tires. You want, you really want 15 inch wheels with some, you know, some give in the sidewall of the tire. So, a turbo bodied Targa or Supersport, you will get some flex.
I think it was the, M491?
That's exactly it. Well done, Jay.
Oh, I feel pleased. I don't even need to say the rest of this. I'm just going to enjoy that.
M491.
It was one of those which I'll tell you now, I'm pretty damn sure we traded for, I think it was six and a half or 7K. We traded this car. Wow. And this hurts me as much as anyone else that's listening, right? it really hurts me because I think that one might have been, could it have been Minerva Blue? No, something like that, something similar to that. Anyway, that was the car. I drove it back from here to where I live and so a decent trek. And that was the car. That was the G Series car that turned me on to the whole thing, to the G Series thing. All of a sudden, I thought, do you know what? This is bloody brilliant. You know, this is really brilliant. And it wasn't, obviously the car wasn't great because otherwise we would have kept it and, you know, gone on with it or whatever. But, you know, it was just like all of a sudden I realized that this old thing that wasn't a great example could still rock. You know, I mean, it was fantastic, you know, whizzing up the most ways and the A roads and all that sort of stuff. And gradually getting into it and sort of like getting, you know, just getting involved with it. And it was just fantastic. And I think that was actually, that revelation has only just come to me whilst we've been talking. That actually was the turning point. So that, and, you know, and from there, actually, I've got a lot of, but to be thankful for that rusty old piece of crap. in that, you know, from there, I sort of worked backwards, you know, into the earlier cars, you know, started, you know, appreciating kind of where this all had come from, you know. Yeah. And
I think personally, Lee, I like the shape and the look of the standard 3.2 Carrera.
Yeah.
But I think if you're going to go Super Sport, go coupe.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
Well, yeah, the last time I drove a Super Sport, I'd just driven an SC, so narrow bodied, lighter car. And so the nuances of M491 were kind of exacerbated, really. So to my mind, it was such a fantastic looking car and a real beautiful looking car because it looks like a turbo. It was almost disappointing to drive by contrast just because it felt quite heavy and cumbersome.
Yeah.
And
you definitely do feel the weight, don't you? Because it's got the turbo, because you have the turbo brakes and the turbo chassis. So it is, you know, there is a bit more weight there, definitely.
Yeah.
And I guess you sort of look at it and you could sort of say, well, if you want that look, why not buy the turbo?
Turbo, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of turbos.
Yeah. And like today's market, something we've said on the podcast before, where the values are at for SSEs and then the genuine, the real deal, the 930.
Mm.
I think, you know, it's only relatively here, it's a small bridge to gap to go into a 930, you know, compared to, a good SSE. And to my mind, I'd want the full fat turbo.
Yeah. You wouldn't buy an aero kitted 996 for 80% of the, you know, you wouldn't pay 80% of the value of a GT3, would you, for an aero kitted car? So
exactly.
I guess if you look at it like that, then yeah, but you know, the turbos are good. They're good. Well, they're great, aren't they? The turbos are good fun.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you've really got to make sure you buy the good car because you could have 13 broken headstocks.
That's mental, that is. I love that story.
Yeah. I think it's funny just where you touched on the cabriolet mark as well. So obviously, yeah, it came along from 83. So, I mean, there's another anniversary this year, of course, but the Targa has more of a history, of course, going back to 67, I think it was. But yeah, the Targa, again, for years, when you look back 10 years and beyond, the Targa was kind of no money at all, really. It was the poor relation to everything else. But then when the 991 generation Targa kind of reinstated that roll bar look, popularity of Targas has kind of soared since then. Yeah. And now in that, G-Series 964 era, it's the cabriolet that really is kind of, you know, thought of less less well thought of compared to the Targa, true. Which is quite the turnaround, really.
I mean, that's the same with the 964 and 993, isn't it? The Cabriolet is the cheapest of those cars. I think an SC Cabriolet would be mega cool. But an early 3.2 Cabriolet, but they're really color conscious. And I think they probably don't suit having, the non-sport Cabriolet is the one to go for, I think, no spoiler. You can buy a sport and de-spoiler it fairly economically. So, I think a sort of metallic colored car, de-spoiler it, get the stance right. And I think it could be a really cool car.
Yeah. That's a great point there. I think for me personally, anyway, of course, this is all subjective. An impact bumper Targa with a whale tail is one of the most visually jarring things you can set your eyes on. It just doesn't work because obviously that side profile of the Targa, it's quite boxy compared to the sleek coupe. And then with this kind of, overt addenda, as well with a tail, it just doesn't quite work. But again, there were a lot of them.
You know how much I love the speedsters, the 89 speedsters, and a couple of years ago I went to look at one and that had a whale tail on it.
Whoa,
did it really?
Yeah.
What, from the factory?
What have you done?
Yeah.
But from you it had a whale tail on it.
Jeez.
Wow. Yeah, it'd be first thing you did with Frisbee. It must be the most squat but longest Porsche ever made, really.
One of one in bad taste. Jeez.
But I think with those speedsters, Lee, like you're saying about the 991 Targa, I think the speedsters for us are easier to. I mean, we've always liked them, haven't we? The 89 speedsters.
Oh yeah.
But recently, the last three we've had in the last year or so have sold. They've been easier to sell. I wonder if that is because people used to go, oh, what? And you say a speedster.
What?
And they go, they've got no idea, unless they knew about early 356s and stuff, they just didn't really relate to it.
Didn't get it,
Since the 991 speedster, I know the 997, they came out with the speedster, but I think definitely since the 991 speedster, that's now, people recognize what that's about.
What the term is,
Yeah,
so it helps a bit easier to sell.
Yeah,
I love that last one you had, which was it silver with the red interior?
Yeah, it was so cool.
It was a beauty.
Yeah,
great condition.
Very nice.
We've spoken before on opinions of speedsters and whatnot, but that really was a beautiful example. When did it go at Christmas time, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, December. Just the time to buy a speedster.
exactly that. Yeah, that is cracking. I think that is a pretty good rundown of impact bumper eras. Of course, we've not touched too much on the early cars, the 2.7 litre cars.
Yeah.
But again, there's so much to talk about into time with all of this impact bumper stuff that we could do another episode on it. It's how how I feel, really. But they are a very different car to the more refined 3.2s with the G50 gearbox from the later 80s, even though they could, to the every man and woman, look the same. They're very different cars.
Yeah, that sort of 74 to 77 era of car to me was almost a run on, they changed the bumpers, but it had a lot to do with the early cars still, didn't they? The mechanicals and the rear wings, obviously, until they flared the rear wings out. The 2.7 was, it's quite a quirky car. I think it's quite a cool car, but it was almost like they put the impact bumpers on the early body.
There were some subtle changes, weren't there? The one piece seats with the headrest incorporated into the seat.
Yeah.
The three spoke wheel rather than the boat four spoke wheel you had on the pre-impact bumper cars. Standout things that I kind of identify over those pre-impact bumper cars. But yeah, you're right. That's exactly what it was, Mark, really, is they had to reclothe their icon to satisfy a critical market in the USA.
Yeah,
it's almost like the comparison between take a 996 and then you've got the 997.1 is very related, then you got the 997.2 is actually a big leap on. It's almost like the SC was a big leap on from the 2.7, but actually looked more or less the same.
Yeah, which is when you look at a 2.7 RS that already had pretty much SC arches. I know their profile's slightly different, but they had it in 73, didn't they? And then it took them another 4 years to sort of put it on the everyday cars. But when you look at it, it makes perfect sense because, you know, the when you put a car on the scales, they're really rear biased, aren't they, with the weight? But they had the same size wheels all the way around on the early cars, didn't they?
Sure.
Yeah, they did, yeah. I know you were... Well, sorry, Mark, go on.
No, just thinking that you'd think, why does it take you so long to realise you want to put slightly bigger, larger rear wheels on this car?
I think with the introduction of the impact pumper cars in 74, where we've mentioned, like those small updates, like the seats and the steering wheel, but also with the introduction of the rear reflector bar in between the two lights, was kind of, it became a design hallmark, really, that's still evidenced right up to today, actually. Even with the 992's light bar as it is now, that kind of just goes all the way around the back, you can trace that via the 997 GTS rear reflector to the 996 C4S's rear reflector, the 993, the 964's was a little bit more upright, and then it goes right the way back to 74 with that. So it's kind of that one design hallmark that's pulled from that era right the way up to the modern day, really.
It's interesting, isn't it, when they sort of keep reintroducing it. They lose it for a while, don't they, like with the 996, and then the 4S had it, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And like, you know, when you get, I think for me, that's an interesting topic, because if you put one of those early cars next to a 992, so again, using that homogeny of that rear reflector and the light bar on the 992, it's a point of reference for the back of the car. And you really see, therefore, just how high up the rear of the 992 starts now before it kind of joins to the roof line. And it makes it look really big and fat and bulky and not particularly pleasant, in my opinion. But those G bodies, by comparison, the roof line almost slopes right the way down to the back of the car where that rear reflector is. It's so much lower, more sleek, more elegant. And I think the worst thing you can do, actually, is park a 992 next to a G body car for that reason, at that angle. It just doesn't it doesn't look right at all.
I think the same, and definitely there's an aero kit rear bumper, isn't there, that is slightly better, because the number plate on some of them are sort of sat really low on 992s, and then there's the aero kit, which like a GT3 would have or something. But I also think that, you know, I like the 992 Touring, but it's getting harder and harder for them to make the back of the car look attractive without spoilers, in a way, isn't it? You know, because the GT3 has got enough interruptions with that spoiler that you sort of, you don't stand back and see, not to say, it's for want of a better word, the ugliness of this current car. You know, it's a Touring. I think it's been quite hard for them with the Touring to make that look as attractive as the 2018 Touring.
Completely agreed. It's something that I've mentioned before on the podcast, and I personally hope, of course, as a non 992 owner anyway, so what's my opinion matter? But when the facelift, the Gen 2 car comes out, I really hope that's addressed, because it's a real design wise Achilles heel of that car, in my opinion. But if anything, as we say, it accentuates the beauty of those early G body cars. And whether you're choosing a really, really early car in a 74, or something that's perhaps a little bit more refined, possibly even sophisticated, certainly with the introduction of Motronic up to the late 80s cars, there's so much choice and so much to dive into. Again, whether it's narrow body, lightweight, I'm using the inverted commas with the Club Sport, wide body, turbo look, the turbo itself, the introduction of the cabriolet. It's kind of by that G series or impact bumper era, that 911 lineup really blossoms in terms of what's available.
Yeah.
I think it'd be interesting when I saw the turbo studied Singer at Goodwood, when I saw the unveiling of that, I thought that'll be interesting to see if that helps impact bumper cars, you know, yes, because people follow Singer, don't they, in a big way. You know, I mean, the 964, you look at the values, it's, and it's not just because they've hoovered a few cars out of the marketplace. You know, 964 values got, you know, appreciated massively in that era of Singer doing, you know, and basing their cars on the 964. It'd be interesting if when they start, you know, we're seeing renderings all the time at the moment of people speccing those turbo studded cars. And obviously that's all done with a, with the impact bumper look. So it'd be interesting if that, that actually lifts the values again.
Very true. Oh, I bought the right one, haven't I?
Yeah.
And what have you got your missus?
Nothing yet. Don't tell her.
Yeah, she was a little bit disgruntled, but it's okay. Got through it.
Well done.
Yeah. You know the drill, Andy. It's easier to seek forgiveness than permission. You know.
I did seek permission first, actually.
Did you really?
I did.
Okay. All right. Well, look, that's a pretty comprehensive roundup of all things G series there. So
thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much for dedicating your time on a Tuesday evening, long after that front door at Paragon has closed to the general public, to impart your knowledge. So we really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been really nice.
Good to chat.
Yeah, good to see you both. Good to talk. Hopefully not as long for the next one.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm going to be coming over your way soon for a Nineworks TV video with some GTSs. I'll touch base with you on that away from the mics. That'd be great.
Cool stuff.
And we do 964 soon.
964 RS special. To be honest, we should. We should. Definitely. I'll have a week off and I'll pass you the mic. I'm joking. We should. Cracking. Yeah, look, Mark and Jay at Paragon, thanks very much for your time.
Cheers, guys.
See you.
Thanks, guys. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Yep. So thanks to Mark and Jay from Paragon GB for joining us for splendid chat. We covered everything, Andy. Everything.
Deep dive.
It did go deep dive. We want to cover our gem of the week, which, of course, we're looking within the Paragon stable, as is only fair. We've mentioned it on the podcast before. It's recently come into stock at Paragon. It's on the Nineworks Marketplace. And it's a lovely, lovely, lovely Guards Red 3.2 Carrera. It's the sport, so whale tail.
Full yuppie spec.
Yeah, exactly that. And it kind of goes off what Mark was saying earlier on in the conversation, whereby finding a unfettled, unmodified, unmolested car for this era tends to be quite rare. And this is definitely one of them. It's priced at $84,995. For the year, so it's 1987, so G50 gearbox, some would say is desirable. It's baby mileage really for the year and for its age. It's only 59,000 miles, less than half of my 996 for context. But yeah, I mean, it is, looking at the pictures, it's absolute time warp. Black leather interior, it's got lovely like red seat piping on it.
A lover of the red piping.
You are, sorry?
Are you a lover of the red piping?
Yeah, I think in that interior, I think it offsets quite well. And actually, if you're being kind of super, super attentive, then actually I think it works really well with like the needles on the clocks.
And the red braces hanging over the steering wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It just pops and gives the right kind, the right amount of flair and detail of colour in that black leather interior. But it is mint. It is absolutely immaculate. Of course, being supplied by Paragon, it's properly prepped, includes a full service before the sale, a new MOT, and a comprehensive 12 months/12,000 miles parts and labour warranty. Go and take a look. It's on the Nineworks Marketplace, and that is our gem of the week.
Lovely.
We're now going to hear from Andy at Heritage Parts Centre, who's going to shed a little bit of light on the most popular upgrades that impact bumper owners tend to go for over at Heritage Parts Centre. Might be useful for you, Andy. Who knows?
Could very well be. I don't know. I don't know if I need to do anything, but yeah, there's going to be bits.
You'll be tinkering.
I can't stop myself. Let's hear what Andy's going to sell me then, as long as he gives me a good discount.
Nineworks 10 at the checkout, don't forget.
Well, no, I want Nineworks 50. Come on. Let's get here from Andy.
Hi chaps, Andy from Heritage Parts Centre here. Great that you're doing a celebration episode on the impact bumper cars. I love an underdog, and after years of being forward dated, then more recently backdated, it's great that these 70s and 80s cars are finally enjoying their moment in the sun. So what can be done for them? On top of a wealth of restoration panels, as let's face it, Porsches of all ages like to rust, and your regular maintenance bits to keep the car running, I've picked a few upgrades out which are popular with our impact bumper customers. The first is the Turbo Spec tie rod kit. These utilise uniball joints as per 930 and will give you a more responsive steering feel for any impact bumper car. Next up is the Sachs Power Clutch. They're 1.7 kilograms lighter than stock, so reduce the rotating mass, which will increase acceleration and responsiveness without making your pedal feel like an on-off switch. For models with CIS injection, the Airbox pop-off valve by URO replaces the leaking original and will help with any vacuum loss issues. SSI heat exchangers are my last suggestion for today. Not only are they stainless steel, so will last you at least 20 years, they're tuned to increase performance in the middle and low RPM and engineered to ensure no exhaust gases can sneak into the cockpit too. Thanks guys, I look forward to listening to the episode.
Andy, thanks for your insight. Much appreciated as always.
And spending my cash.
Yes, and hopefully one or two others. Don't forget though, we like to save a little bit of money here at Nineworks, so entering the code NINEWORKS10 at the checkout will get you up to 10% off.
Lovely.
From there, we mentioned earlier that we were going to talk about gearboxes, 915 and G50.
I'm interested in this.
Yeah, this is cool for two reasons. Number one, there's a hell of a lot of information coming your way right now. I went to Chris at Rightune a couple of weeks ago, took the mics, and the intention was for me to interview Chris, his father, Tony Wright, and Joe as well from Rightune, interview them, get a conversation going as to gearboxes. As I said, interesting for two reasons. Number one, a load of information in that conversation, which I hope you'll enjoy. The second reason, though, is, well, Chris nicked the microphone off me, and so I'm barely in it. Chris basically took over and I think is out there somewhere now forming a new career podcast. As some sort of, yeah, podcast presenter. He was fantastic. Really, really good. So this is quite an organic chat, really, from the boys at Rightune talking about the differences, nuances, and everything in between for 915 and the G50 gearbox.
Awesome. I look forward to this and interested to find out. Hopefully I bought the right car with the right gearbox. Cool. Let's hear from him.
Okay. Right. Yes. Here we go. Oof.
It's the comedy sketch.
You don't know. It can very well be. It can very well be. It's a nice relaxed atmosphere here at Rightune today. I'm joined by Chris and Tony Wright and Joe Carter. And Mike's in the background as well. Shout out to Mike in the background underneath the C4S at the moment. Chaps, we've gathered you today to talk about gearboxes, specifically the 915 and G50 unit from the impact bumper years. So we're going to leave the four-wheel drive G50 from the 964, 993 and just focus on the rear-wheel drive 1986 to 89 years. You've had quite a lot of experience. I'm looking at you, Tony, in particular. You've had quite a lot of experience with these gearboxes over the years, owing to your vast experience.
I have.
No indication for your age.
Thank you. Go on then, ask me a question about 915 and G50 gearboxes. What do you want to know specifically?
We want to know everything. I want to take absolutely everything that's in your brain on these gearboxes and put it on the podcast. So yeah, like... Are they reliable, first of all? Let's start at the top.
They are reliable. They don't. What they suffer from mainly is people trying to do fast changes with them.
But that's with a 915, right?
Well, both really. 915 suffers more from people trying to change gear quickly than the G50, although they can suffer from that as well.
But by the slightly, would you say that using a 915 gearbox is more, well, less user friendly than a G50?
It is to somebody that can't drive. Yes.
I love it.
Good.
Cheers, Chris. In my experience, a 915, I've said on the podcast plenty of times before, it's almost like the difference between a good or a bad impact bumper car is all down to the that gearbox and the condition of it. If it's like stirring porridge, it's an absolute nightmare to drive. If it's a really good gearbox, it's a joy to drive. It really is that kind of night and day, whereas a G50 just seems to work.
I think the problem with 915s is they're so varied, I find. When I drive them, some of them drive really well and others drive poorly. But not G50s, I tend to find they all drive pretty similar, no matter how many miles they've done. But, you know, that's, as a younger person, it's probably just, obviously I've driven more modern cars and like Tone's driven all old stuff normally, you know, back in the day. But that's my personal opinion. It's if you get a good one or not. They sit, yeah, 915s tend to be on the scale of things. Some are really good and some aren't. And G50s tend to be, you can get, no matter how many miles it's done, they seem to change the same unless it's really been abused.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we had one with 400,000 miles on it, didn't we? Tony's Club Sport. And it drove.
Yeah, not my Club
Sport. Not your Club Sport, no. But another customer called Tony. It drove like a one that had done 50,000 miles. So.
Why is that then?
The selector arrangement in the G50 is completely different to what it is in a 915. It's very difficult to crunch the synchros in a G50 because of the way the selector mechanism is inside the gearbox. So if you're going from say fifth to fourth in a G50, it's almost got it's got its own sort of gate in there, a bit like a Ferrari gate. So it's virtually impossible to go into reverse gear, for argument's sake, from fifth. Whereas in a 915, if it's really badly worn and not set up correctly, and the linkage is all worn, that can happen. You can come from fifth if you're coming back into fourth and catch reverse gear, which in a G50 you just can't do that. So they improved the selector mechanism arrangement inside the gearbox with the G50, and that's what makes them easier to drive. And I think that makes it the longevity of the gearbox before it needs rebuilding longer than a 915. Yeah, yeah. The synchro mesh system in the G50 as well is different to a 915. It's more robust.
Are the internals of a G50 more? Are there more? Is there more? Is it more complicated internally?
Yes. The G50 is slightly more complicated. Yes, it is definitely.
In what respect?
The selector mechanism.
Okay, and so since my time being here at RightTune, we've done a lot of 915 gearbox rebuilds. We change typically a lot of synchros, dog teeth, bearings. Those are the most more common parts that we're changing the gearbox. Sometimes we have worn gears.
Worn gears is very unusual. Yeah. That can be down to lack of oil, wrong oil, generally.
What about crown wheel and pinion wear?
Yeah, that's can happen with either of them, depending on mileage.
And people setting it up wrong.
Yeah, and obviously if it's been apart and they've got the backlash or the depth of mesh of the pinion wrong, which can happen easily.
But the material, you don't see it breaking up. Like, I know you had a lot of problems when you used to do 996 gearboxes and stuff with them wearing down. Typically, if the gearbox has been built correctly and it's not been stood around, for example, and it's got oil in it, you're not going to see too many issues, usually.
With a G50?
Or either a 915.
Well, no, I mean, 915 crown wheel and pinion and G50 crown wheel and pinions, no. Yes, they do wear. Obviously, if it's done 200,000 miles plus, you expect there'll be some wear there.
And we've also had problems with 915 cases, which obviously you didn't have when they were current, which is we're seeing problems with corrosion, particularly, obviously, the earlier cases. It's a mechanical, where you take this from, I'm talking about the speedo.
The very early 915 is a mechanical.
Yeah, it's a mechanical speedo that comes out of the end case, isn't that right, Joe?
The later ones have got an electronic speedo, and they're the ones that are problematic because they corrode.
Yeah.
It's a very thin piece of material between the sensor and the inside of the gearbox. and it corrodes away and then it leaks.
What sort of, were you saying it was the later ones, Joe? Do you know what model year?
3.2 Carreras, so 915s. Right, okay. So sort of 85.
Does an SC as well have that type? And yes. Carrera 3?
SCs are, Carrera, yeah, they are
mechanical. I can't actually remember the top of my head.
Oh, I haven't had Carrera. I can't remember.
Because Carrera 3's magnesium case 915, isn't it? I'm almost 100%
Mag
sure.
Case 915 is like the one behind us. Yeah, they're mechanical speedo.
Yeah.
But that's in early cars like which that, this is.
Yeah. Which, yeah, they can't see that because we're on the podcast. It's the 1970s.
1970 we're talking about, a mechanical speedo.
Joe, you mentioned something away from the mic, so I think it's worth bringing up again in regards to weight. We're talking about weight of the 915 versus G50.
Oh, yeah.
And you said about the club sport.
Well, yeah, like an ordinary 3.2 Carrera with a 915 gearbox is the same weight as a club sport because they take all the weight out of the club sport and then put the G50 in, which is, you know, it's a lot heavier. So,
yeah,
that's another thing to consider. They are a sizable gearbox compared to a 915. I mean, got one over there. It's, you know, it's probably 50 kilos nearly.
I can pick a 915 gearbox up, but I can't pick a G50 one up.
Right, okay. So G50 is fair to say is more robust, but there is a weight penalty to that over a 915.
Yeah.
Tony, you've got a 3.2.
I have.
Carrera. What box is in that?
915. 84 car.
Right, okay. So do you prefer, as a driver, do you prefer a 915 or a G50?
Makes no difference to me.
Yeah? You're just slick and fast anyway. The fastest no matter what.
Yeah, but yours works properly.
mine works, yeah. I don't have any problem changing gear in any mechanical, manual car ever.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean 901 is probably the worst one.
Yeah, 901 it can be a little bit hot in your mouth.
You challenge the
clutch up slowly because you're not on what. Yeah, if they're sorted again, not too bad. But some of them, you're like, oh Jesus, what gear am I in?
Yeah, a badly worn one is diabolical. Yeah. But when they're not worn and you've rebuilt it and it's fine if you can drive.
So what about if somebody finds an impact bumper car and it's priced accordingly and it needs a gearbox rebuild? Worst case scenario, how much are we looking at in this day and age?
Well, that's can of worms, isn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult. It used to be sort of 2 to 3. Now seeing bills of 5 upwards. If it, and that's not without, that's without gears. You could do 10 grand on a gearbox if it needs gears and that's if they're available.
How much was that one we did on that one 915 that had a 964 engine in it? The orange car.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was expensive.
That was about 10 grand, wasn't it? Because that was really...
Yeah, but that was over... Then you got, in that instance, the gearbox had a lot more power than it was ever designed to take, didn't it?
Well, yeah, that's true. But they're not massively labour-intensive once the box is out, is it? To strip and rebuild it. It's the parts you get. And then... You've got to be aware as well, a lot of the things, some of the gears aren't available now. There are gears available
aftermarket,
but they can be very noisy, even though they're marketed as, you know, perfect. We've done that before, changed gear sets, and it's been, whining in a gear, right, Dad?
Absolutely, yeah.
So best to stick with Porsche, from what you're saying.
Yes.
From our experience, generally. Yes. I'm sure there are companies out there that produce a good product, but yet to find one. Yeah, we'd prefer just to stick to that, but that's just us, because obviously if we build a box and it's noisy in a gear, then we have it out and apart again. But yeah, I mean, all these gearboxes are getting old and worn, so...
So do they, by way of a rule of thumb, does a 915 have a life to it in terms of mileage?
Or no. It comes down to how it's been driven.
Basically. And it is a lot easier for us as... or these guys more so as engineers to drive the car first. So we do get given a gearbox on, you know, somebody will turn up and give it to us out the back of a van or a car. But it does help to also drive the box as well. And wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely.
In much, much better. You can often not always see or measure a problem, but you can feel it from driving it. So that is more helpful that way to drive the car and then take the box out and do the whole job together.
Yeah. Okay. I suppose one last question I've got to put is, Porsche's kind of known for this constant evolution, particularly with the 911, but did that happen with a gearbox at all? Was there
much of a change from the early 915 up to the very late 915?
Well, the early 915 is magnesium for a start.
So they're a lot lighter.
Yeah. So they're lighter, yeah. But and obviously mechanical speedo as well, the early ones.
Yeah, they evolved the gearbox over the years, the 915.
There's also been like engineering solutions people have come up with where the boxes have done a lot more mileage and had a lot more stress on them than ever was anticipated. They probably didn't think things like the mag box was still going to be used. So there's different solutions like companies like Weaver and stuff, and I think EB Motorsport and others. You can machine out a bit, haven't you, where the two bearings go?
Yeah.
Is it in the bell housing bit? And or is it the other end? It's in the bell housing part,
yeah.
And you put an aluminium piece in there because you put the bearings in and it's worn and they just turn. They're not
short shifters make them reduce their life as well. 915s, they're like short shifters.
It's short term, it feels better, but it wears the synchros up faster, right?
Rushing them basically, and it wears them out quicker.
Interesting. And this was available from Porsche. They did do a short shift kit, and that just makes the gearbox wear out quicker. Because you're rushing the synchros again.
Yeah, interesting.
I think that's a really bad idea, personally.
A lot of people like to do that because otherwise, those G series cars, it is quite a long row through.
Yeah, And I think that was probably done on purpose
to slow down
to give the synchro time to actually work.
Yeah.
You know, the brake band or whatever you want to call it, to slow the gear or speed it up so that the dog teeth are engaged on the bit that locks it into gear.
Yeah. Well, this is first class consumer advice on Nineworks Radio, because we're usually charged with spending enthusiasts money on different bits and pieces, but for once we're saying actually that's, you know, keep your money in your wallet.
Yeah.
And it might actually help with the longevity of the gearbox as well.
Definitely.
Interesting. Very interesting. What else have I got down here? I kind of think
they're also not compatible chassis to chassis.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
You can't. If you've got a 915 3.2 Carrera, for instance, you can't just bolt in a G50, even though they did G50 3.2s. All the torque tube is completely different, and the torsion bars are different. So
you'll need a very big hammer.
Grinder.
Chainsaw.
But so that's just another thing. If you've got a 915 car and you're thinking about putting a G50 in it, you can do it, but it's not easy.
Yeah. Kind of probably wouldn't make financial sense, I would assume.
Well, we have done it.
Oh, seriously, yeah. Okay. Well, look, we've spoken a lot here about the nuances of the 915, but is that G50 as bulletproof as its reputation will have it believe? I've personally never really known of them going wrong. There's no recalcitrance from cold like there is in a 915. It's a really easy gearbox to get along with, to use, but what about to maintain?
Yeah, I mean, everything wears, doesn't it? But they tend to wear slower than...
I think they're by and large, and not everybody's like you, Dad, that they are easier to drive, I think, G50. And
I think they wear less because they're designed to take more horsepower as well. Like so the 915 can't take as much horsepower as a G50, which obviously reduces the wear of the G50, doesn't it, if it can take more power. Yeah.
You said, Joe, as well, in terms of rebuilding them, to you, they make more sense because the gears are linear.
Yeah, to whereas me, but I'm strange. I mean, you know, he finds 915.
There is, more all over the place.
What are all over the place?
The gears.
On a G50, right? The gears go on first, second, third, fourth, and on a 915, the ones at the end don't, do they?
No.
Yeah. But, you know, to you, that's more logical, isn't it? Compared to other gearboxes that you've worked on, not Porsche, is it like an orthodox design, like the gearbox, or is it peculiar to Porsche? Is it unique to Porsche?
The answer to that is a yes and a no. It's because it's a transaxle.
Yeah.
It's completely different to say something in a Ford Cortina or Sierra, for argument's sake, or any of those normal road cars.
Oh, here's a man with a G50. He's got a Club Sport. He's got a 3.2 Club Sport. Just walked in the door.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Throw it down. Get it covered in oil. Cover the mic in oil. Well, look, what else do you want to know? What else can we talk about, do you think? Can you think of, Joe?
I
don't know. What do people normally want to know about them?
I think it's a...
By the large, the G50 I think a doesn't lot of go it, wrong as much, does it?
I think a lot of people prefer to, you know, have a G50 car, don't they?
Definitely. I think on values, if you have this, you know, other parameters that come into it, like paperwork and condition of the rest of the car, but if you have two cars at a fairly identical condition, service history,
the G50
is more sought after.
Yeah, I think that's hype, isn't it? A lot of people, you know what things are like. Yeah, people keep saying it's the best, so that's what they've got to have. But yeah, personally, I probably would slightly choose the G50, but that's only because I find them slightly easier to drive. That's the only reason.
It's easier to drive, and with this kind of reputation for being bulletproof, there's longevity to it. You know, it's perceived that with a G50 gearbox, well, that's something you don't have to worry about. It's got a G50, it's bulletproof, etc.
Yeah.
My personal thing is, yes, while that may be the case, don't, and this is to people at home, you know, don't dismiss a 915, give it a go. Yeah. I think a really good 915 is a more enjoyable, more engaging driving experience than a G50, which by comparison can feel just very neutral.
Well, I agree. A well-built 915 is a good gearbox to use. But like I said earlier, it's just that they vary so much. G50s tend to be, even if they're slightly worn, they're still quite easy to use. But with a 915, when it's worn, it's like stirring a pudding, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. What I mean, it is. But I think personally that 915's more interesting to drive because it's a bit more of like a sense of occasion. You'll feel like you're operating some machinery, where a G50, you get in it and don't really think about it. It operates much more like you're driving a modern car, but that might lose for some, and to me, some of the characteristic or charm of you're driving a peculiar car with the engine in the back.
Yeah, maybe it's too refined. Maybe that could be.
Could be for some, but some people prefer that because it could be argued that it works. Its operation is better, you know, for the user. So you know, I can see both. Both sides of both arguments.
Yeah, I think if you've got a cabriolet or a Targa, you're going to want the G50. It just goes with that sort of car. You want to be able to jump in. It's easy to drive. It doesn't matter that there's a weight penalty because the car is, you know,
heavier anyway.
It's heavier anyway and compromised, I would say, dynamically over a coupe. Whereas, you know, if you've got a sporty coupe, there's a lovely, like a US Spec SC outside the front here. I don't know, you know, obviously that we'll have a 915 gearbox, but if that's a good gearbox, that's a cracking car.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Cracking car, you know, so.
Yeah, of course.
I think, unless there's anything else that you guys want to cover, I feel like that's a pretty good comprehensive deep dive.
You might want to ask him some stuff about his motorsport applications, maybe, I don't know, but that's not really probably what you're doing.
Well, so this is it, and I want to share a bit of a secret with our Nine Wax Radio listeners.
They also use a G50 in an Ultima as well.
Oh, do
upside
they?
Down, yeah. Not that that matters to anybody, but I'll just throw it in.
Well, if there is a crossover here on the Venn diagram of listeners, and you have got an Ultima, then if you've got an Ultima and a 3.2 or an impact bumper 911, there's more in common than you might think. But we have certainly, I have for quite a while wanted to get Tony on this podcast because he's got an incredible story and history to tell, particularly going back to motorsport, 80s, 90s. He's messed around with GT1s, has he not?
Yeah, 935s. All the sort of stuff, 935s, RSRs, GT2, GT3s, and like race cars in the 70s, not just Porsches, but lots
Turbo, the first 993 in the country.
Really?
Yeah, they bought one from the factory road car and turned it into a GT1.
Right, so he's fairly warmed up then on the spanners.
he's got a few.
Well, I really would like Tony to be able to tell his story at some point. So hopefully, if he dipping his toe in the water here,
it's quite difficult getting on the mic, and he's already run off to speak to someone about his 3.2 Club Sport.
No, it's great. It's great. It's the nature of a family-run business, and we love it. We have really enjoyed this. Like I say, deep dive into gearboxes. It doesn't get more kind of geeky than that, does it? Really.
So. No, I know. I've got my glasses on today and everything.
I've got my anorak.
yeah, exactly. That is so anoraky. But Chris, Joe and Tony in the background somewhere, live from Wrightune as we are in the workshop currently. Thanks very much for imparting your knowledge on How Much Radio today.
Thanks, Lee.
Quality, thank you.
Say goodbye to Mike, everyone.
Yeah, bye, Mike. See you later, Mike. Mike in the back. Bye. Grand. So thanks to Chris for hogging the mic. I mean, presenting, doing a great job presenting.
I've learned lots.
To be honest, it was great. Really enjoyed that. Real organic chat. And yeah, wow. Loads of information on there, which I hope you'll find useful, Andy.
I'm sure I will. Yeah. A little bit of tinkering to be done, I think.
Yeah, I think the main thing is you've got to find the right gearbox for you. That 915 is a wonderful gearbox.
I'm so looking forward to mastering it.
I want to master it
and tweak with it so that it's, I'm so looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's exactly the word. You know, the 950, which obviously came along from 1986, those last couple of
years. G50.
Yes, what did I say?
950, I think.
950, yeah, that'll do. Some sort of hybrid between the two.
You did look a bit, what am I saying as you said it?
God knows, mate, God knows. But yeah, the G50 gearbox from 1986 to 89, so those late 3.2 Carreras, is a nice gearbox, really palatable, really easy to use. Mm. But actually some of the 915's nuances actually translate into some of its charm.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's about finding the right car for you and how you use the car.
Yeah. Well, I found that today driving mine and kind of learning it. You know, I've only done, 25 miles, I guess, today.
Yeah.
But already I'm kind of understanding what I need to do and getting around things. I've done a couple of little crunches here and there, but so it definitely needs mastering, but yeah. Wonderful. Enjoyed it.
Cracking.
Good.
Cool, man. Well, look, away from impact bumpers, we need to talk about new collective members. Andy, I hear there's been lots.
Yeah, it's been a few more. So good. Thank you, everybody.
Absolutely.
Amazing. And obviously, thank you to everybody that's been a collective member for a while as well. Always appreciated.
It is indeed. It really, really is.
Right. Shall I give you a little rundown?
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Right. First up, we've got Neil Blackmore. Who we met over in France. He was the guy at the chateau that parked next to us in the CSR.
Do you remember? Yes, I do.
The Wirral. Yes.
Oh, the Wirral. I apologize. Yes. Oh. I have it on good authority that if you're from the Wirral, you're explicitly not to be called a Scouser.
That's like calling an Australian a New Zealander.
Kiwi. Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah. So welcome to Neil, who's a rookie, 996 CSR, number 5, apparently. He's had it for a while.
Yeah, so it was a real view, wasn't it?
Yeah, hopes to be at Sheffield in a couple of weeks. Next up, we have Gareth Reed, who is a rookie. He is from Essex, Saffron Walden, and he has a 996 40th anniversary. They're everywhere at the moment. Where have they all come from?
Lovely, lovely. Yeah, and the star is set to rise on them. You've heard it here first, without a doubt. Nice to have another Essex local on board as well.
Excellent. Right, next up, Tom Haynes, who is a rookie. He is in Newbury, and he has a 996 C4S in Bolsalt Black. His parents have got a few different a Cayman, a Boxster, and a C4S.
Nice.
Still grey with the nephrite green interior.
Oh, nephrite. Yeah. Do you know what? That is so cool. Funny enough, if you'd have said 10 years ago, nephrite green interior, you'd have chunned it into your cup. But now that's one of the coolest things going. Honestly, it's funny, isn't it? It's funny how tastes and trends change and fluctuate over time, but that is seriously cool these days.
I reckon that'll look really good with the seal gray.
Yes.
Nice. Welcome, Tom. Next up is Ian Cleary. Who is a privateer from North Lincolnshire. Been a podcast subscriber and YouTube channel for quite a while. He drives a 994 2.7 and 944. Apologies, it's my number dyslexia coming in there. 944 2.7, and he also has a very early 996 1998.
Lovely to have some transaxle love in there as well. That's fantastic
indeed. Next up is William Wong, who's a works driver from Twickenham in London. has been listening to the podcast way back when, to Road to Redline days. He is said he's very lucky to own a 997.2 C4S in brackets manual, which he's had just since May 21. Had lots of hot hatches and stuff before that, but loving the Porsche action. His biggest regret is not getting a 964 or a 993 when they were 20-odd K when he was in his 20s. I think we all regret that. There's one of us that don't. You're not alone there, William.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up is David Inskip, who is a privateer from Tottenham in North London, currently driving a 996 C4S Midnight Blue with a Metropole Blue interior. Again, just works now, doesn't it, for some reason. He has got a few tweaks on there, including KWV3 and a PCCM Plus.
Lovely.
Good choice on the KWV3s, good sir. Right, next up is Mark Jordan, works driver from South Leicestershire. Ooh, lots going on here. I should have read this one before. There's lots going on. He currently has a 997 GTS 2011 that was purchased from JZM during lockdown. Loves it to bits. Fred, there's lots of other stuff going on there, but I haven't got time to go through it. Mark, but welcome aboard.
Yeah, welcome, Mark.
Right, and one last one. That's Harry Bentley, who is an Englishman living in Hong Kong at the moment. At home in the UK, has a 997 GTS in aqua blue metallic. I wonder if that's Toby's old car. And also a 997.1 GT3 in cobalt blue. He says, don't ask me why I have two such similar cars in the stable, but as you probably can tell, I'm a big fan of the 997. Yeah, not doing much driving as he's in Hong Kong at the moment, but that intends to make up for it when he gets home. I've got a couple of others that have joined up, but I haven't got any information for those. That's Rob Verhul, who's a rookie driver, and James Wyatt, who's a works driver. Actually, we do know James. He drives the white GT3 that's got the loudest exhaust in the world.
You'll hear him long before you see him. And it was indeed James's GT3, funnily enough, it popped up on the collective WhatsApp chat.
Yes.
WhatsApp chat. I think somebody found it roadside in London.
And, driven, not hidden.
Driven, very much driven, not hidden. And that was James's car. We've managed to commandeer him into the collective group as a result. So, good work team on that, I would say. Yeah, and welcome,
good
James.
Recruiting. Excellent. Yeah. And we have one upgrade, and it's a big one this week. It's Mike Bicknell, who's gone from works to hero.
Has he really? Wow. He has indeed.
Thank you, Mike.
Amazing. Thanks, Mike. Mike's a real big supporter of what we're doing on Nineworks. And as we say to all of our hero drivers, like, we're just beyond grateful that you'd want to go up to that top, top, top level of membership. And we will make sure that you will be looked after over the next year or so. So thank you for joining us on Nineworks.
Absolutely. That is over and out on the update on Driven Not Hidden Collective.
Amazing. I do want to say as well, just while we're on the subject of collective,
yeah,
my brother back in Essex has moved house this week to a village just outside Colchester. And I don't want to give the exact location away because it's not fair to his neighbour. But on the day he moved in, I happened to be back in Essex. I was doing some filming with Garage Therapy, and I popped over to take a look. And I noticed that his new next door neighbour has two Porsches on the drive, and Gen 2 996. And it was, I couldn't see the color because it was at night, but I did spot a sapphire blue 981 Cayman. And your favorite car in the middle, it was an Audi A2. And
hey,
which you're a big fan of as a former owner. But
he's the man.
I did point out to my brother,
full respect,
Joe,
for the A2.
Full respect. Yeah, that's a good three car garage, that. But I did point out to Joe that he's got some work to do to turn his neighbour into a new collective owner. If it's somebody listening to this podcast, then welcome. My brother's a bloody nightmare.
Oh, brilliant.
No, he's fine. He's absolutely fine. He turns the music down at 2 a.m. Yes, hopefully we can, commandeer and recruit into the collective via some neighbourly love over in Essex there.
Excellent. Love it. Love it.
Yeah. This episode was brought to you by our very kind Driven Not Hidden collective. If you would like to join the collective to get further access and rewards within the Nineworks community, you can do so at patreon.com/Nineworks. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review on your favourite podcast app.